it helped us realize that we need to focus on the person, on the kid, on the child, on the parent, on the family.
The state's health commissioner hears testimony on reforming Medicaid from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 29th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state opens a new library for rocks.
Compared to dark Connex out in Eagle River with a flashlight is a huge step forward. This is a world-class facility in Alaska. Should be very proud of it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Alaska Public Media and Alaska Dispatch News are taking the state to court because the state government has failed to provide documents regarding the National Guard scandal. The two media outlets sued the state on October 8th after being denied public records requests filed last spring. The Attorney General's office agreed to provide emails, documents, and logs related to the scandal to avoid going to court. To this date, they have only provided a few emails. The media outlets are asking the courts to expedite the process and hear the suit as soon as possible. They want the governor's office to provide the documents before next week's election. In the request to the court, the media outlets say they believe the attorney general's office is trying to get the documents, but that they are reaching a bottleneck at the governor's office. The judge will hold a hearing on the issue tomorrow afternoon. The state's Medicaid Reform Advisory Group has met for the last 6 months in relative obscurity. That changed today when more than 200 parents, doctors, and therapists showed up to testify about a list of proposed innovations the group hopes will help curtail the growing cost of the program. The message the group heard was that the reforms would have huge impacts on the people who rely on Medicaid for health services. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Jamie Robinson approached the microphone with an 11-month-old snuggled on her chest in a baby carrier.
I hope you guys don't mind if I stand up.
We'll be very quiet.
Well, it's okay. This is my fourth, so he's used to lots of noise.
Robinson's second child, a first grader named Brooke, is one of more than 150,000 Alaskans who benefit from the state's Medicaid program. Brooke has cerebral palsy and other developmental problems. Robinson says she was born by emergency C-section.
She's my miracle child because she should have died. Sorry, it's so emotional.
Robinson says basically Brooke is now walking and talking and thriving in school. She says her daughter has benefited from frequent occupational, physical, and speech therapy. One of the proposed reforms would limit the number of therapy sessions to no more than 6 a year. After that, a patient would need to be reevaluated. Robinson says frequent evaluations would be harmful to Brooke, and cutting back on therapy would be devastating.
You got to think of this as a gym membership, right? If you go to a gym, if you go 6 times a year, are you going to see any results? No, you are not. You have to go and you have to work your body. And she works her butt off.
Nearly everyone who testified in the morning talked about problems with requiring frequent evaluations for therapy. And it was a message Division of Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Struer had heard even before the meeting began. He committed to revisiting the issue.
It was excellent testimony, and it helped us realize that we need to focus on the person, on the kid, on the child, on the parent, on the family.
Commissioner Struer says he was pleased with the level of public involvement at the meeting. He says he heard good recommendations on specific reform ideas. One of the things he took away from the meeting is that a cookie-cutter approach to reform won't work.
Focus the treatment on the stuff that you preach about, Struer, and that's the right care, right time, right place for the right person. So it has to be person-specific. And what we came out with were broad general recommendations, and folks have come back to us and said, tailor it, and we can live with it.
Commissioner Struer says he's committed to getting a list of reform ideas to the governor by November 15th, but he says that's just the start of the next phase of the process, which will involve more analysis on each reform. Still, for committee member Sandra Heffern, the testimony highlighted how rushed the process has been. Governor Parnell announced he was creating the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group last November. Members were appointed in March and have been meeting monthly since April. Heffern, who is a health consultant with a background in home health care services, says there hasn't been enough time for deep discussion on the recommendations.
The recommendations are, these are things that we need to further explore, but to say that we're going to do any kind of reform based on the innovations that have been brought forward, I think is, I don't want to use the word ludicrous, but that's what comes to mind.
Several people who testified brought up new reform ideas for the group to consider, like paying for hospice care at the end of life to save on hospital costs and reusing expensive medical equipment like wheelchairs. That last idea came from Medicaid recipient Rick Nelson, who uses a wheelchair and serves on the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. He's also getting a graduate degree in public administration. Speaking through an interpreter, he left the committee with this thought.
So without these services or therapies, I would not have been able to be who I am today. So I ask you to please look carefully at what you're doing. You might affect somebody like me. Thank you, and you never know, he might be the next commissioner.
In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The U.S. Department of Justice may intervene in an Alaska Supreme Court case concerning a non-Native couple's adoption of an Alaska Native child. In September, the Native village of Tununuk lost its appeal against the state of Alaska and the adoptive couple. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
DOJ is trying to determine, does the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Baby Veronica case apply to the Tununuk case? Baby Veronica was about a private adoption. The Tununuk case is concerned with a state-sanctioned adoption. Matt Newman is an attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, which has been involved in the Tununuk case as a friend of the court.
I think what is definitely of note and definitely what was a bit surprising is the Tununuk decision is now on the radar of the Department of Justice. And through this extension, you know, they're certainly not committing to anything. They're not saying we have a brief to file, but they're at least showing that there's an interest in the case at levels higher than just the bar here in Alaska.
The fate of a 6-year-old the court calls Dawn is at stake. Dawn was placed into foster care as an infant in Anchorage near her mother in the hope that they could be reunited. That was a deviation from the Indian Child Welfare Act, which mandates a preference for Native family placement. But the tribe and the child's grandmother, Elise, agreed, initially. After a year, Dawn was placed with a new non-Native family, the Smiths, who are now trying to finalize their adoption of her. 3 years after Dawn first entered the state of Alaska's custody, her mother's parental rights were terminated. After the termination, the tribe argued that keeping Dawn in Anchorage was no longer warranted, and they stepped up their efforts to have Dawn placed with her grandmother in Tununuk. According to the September decision, Elise had requested custody of Dawn since the beginning and had made efforts to bring her home into compliance for placement. During the last appeal, the state court had initially granted the tribe a stay of the adoption. 4 days later, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinion in Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, otherwise known as the Baby Veronica case. In light of this, the state court requested supplemental arguments from the parties. Because the grandmother did not formally file for adoption, the court reasoned that the Baby Veronica decision meant that there was no ICWA placement preference to apply. A window to appeal the decision to federal court closed Friday, the same day that the DOJ requested its own extension. The DOJ wrote that, quote, the United States has a strong interest in the interpretation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, end quote, and that the department was not aware of the case until after the September decision. The DOJ has until November 24th to decide if it will intervene in the case. The Village of Tununuk's tribe is being represented by Alaska Legal Services Corporation. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a national survey gives Alaska some criticism and kudos for energy efficiency.
The state government-led initiatives are where our score is very good, actually.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by The historic Anchorage Hotel, a mix of historical architecture and modern technology, offers banquet facilities with catering and bartenders, a boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com.
Candidates for Alaska's seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate squared off at a forum in Fairbanks Tuesday. On the Senate side, Republican Dan Sullivan relentlessly tried to tie incumbent Democrat Mark Begich to President Obama and Majority Leader Harry Reid.
Under the Obama administration, where you've supported those policies 97% of the time, most of that has been about consolidating power in Washington, consolidating power with regard to D.C. bureaucrats, whether that's Obamacare, whether that's Dodd-Frank. And I think that Alaskans have a very different approach.
Sullivan also reminded Begich that Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski took issue with a Begich political advertisement suggesting she supported the Democrats. Begich responded saying he and Murkowski mostly vote the same way.
You know, when you have an 80% voting record together this last year on every single item, I'm for that. That's what we need more of in Washington, D.C. than the partisan bickering that goes on, especially in this campaign, by my opponent, who all he talks about is Reid and Obama. This is about Alaska and what's important for Alaska.
Candidates vying for the House seat talked about the problem of gridlock in Washington. Democrat Forrest Dunbar pointed to term limits as part of the solution, citing the connection between Washington, D.C. K Street lobbying firms and Congress.
Right now, there's a huge incentive for those staffers to go to K Street firms for million-dollar salaries and then funnel money back to their former bosses on various committees. We need to reform D.C., reform the system in D.C., and that will help change the partisan nature of our capital.
Incumbent Congressman Don Young, the longest-serving Republican in the House, blamed the ineffectiveness of Congress on a structural shift.
When I was chairman of both of my committees, the partisanship did not exist. We worked together. And then Nancy Pelosi created what we call brain trust in the Speaker's office. The Speaker runs the Congress, regardless of Democrat and Republican, and the chairman have no real authority anymore. I want to get the chairmanship back to have the authority to run the Congress.
Libertarian House candidate Jim McDermott maintained a third-party representative is the best way to break up the zero-sum game being played in Washington.
The elite side of the Democrats and Republicans are in a room with a can of paint and a brush. They start at the door. There's only one exit, and they paint themselves into a corner. So they don't have any room to maneuver. They have to go one way or the other, or I guess they get thrown out and annexed out of the party. Where in the Libertarian Party, we obviously are going to start painting towards the door, which means we're going to give ourselves options.
The House and Senate candidates also responded to questions on numerous other topics during the forum sponsored by the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, ranging from resource development to health care and the federal deficit. A jury trial is set for early January for a Wrangell doctor accused of distributing and viewing child pornography. KTOO's Matt Miller has more from Juneau.
A not guilty plea was entered for Dr. Greg Szilard during his arraignment in U.S. District Court in Juneau on Tuesday. Dressed in orange prison garb, slip-on sneakers, and leg shackles, Szilard said nothing except "Yes, ma'am," in response to the magistrate judge's routine questions. His handcuffs were taken off during the hearing inside the courtroom. His federal defense attorney, Kara McNamara, entered his plea for him. Wednesday of last week, Szilard was indicted by a grand jury on two counts of sexual exploitation of a child. One charge is for the alleged distribution of child pornography, and the other charge is for the alleged possession of child pornography. If convicted, Szilard could face a maximum total of 30 years in prison, $500,000 in fines, and a lifetime of supervised release. Szilard was arrested at his home in Wrangell on October 15th as he allegedly tried to delete pornographic images from his home computer. Starting in May, federal investigators allegedly tracked Szilard as he used his computer and a peer-to-peer network to trade in sexually explicit photos and videos of children. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Nikiski residents are frustrated by a recent rash of property crimes and are dissatisfied with law enforcement's response. A state agency set up to help crime victims claims there is a larger trend of disenfranchisement among property crime victims across Alaska. KBBI's Quentin Chandler reports.
Earlier this month at a town hall meeting, Kenai District Attorney Scott Leader suggested Nikiski residents who were dissatisfied with the progress made by law enforcement could turn to the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights. The state agency lends an ear to crime victims and helps them navigate the intricacies of the criminal justice system.
Also, we can represent them in court since our office does have four attorneys.
Taylor Winston is the agency's executive director. Recently, Nikiski residents haven't been piling into her office in droves looking for help. In fact, she said she couldn't find any recent cases from the area, but her office handles similar concerns regularly.
We've had cases where people before reporting were in fear, and that's sometimes why they hesitated to report. They report and they are even more afraid after that because of some retribution. We've had a number of cases around the state that we've dealt with.
Fear of criminal retribution is just one of the concerns Nikiski residents have confided to the Peninsula Clarion. There is also a fear that criminals are afforded more rights than victims, and residents complained even when offenders are prosecuted, the punishments don't go far enough. Winston says she's heard similar complaints from victims of other property crimes across Alaska.
Often the reports aren't taken, or if the report is taken, it's minimized or not investigated. And I know, law enforcement, they're strapped. I mean, resources are strapped, and they also have to do priorities, with the violent offenders.
In Winston's experience, that isn't much comfort to the person whose home is burglarized. She says victims are often left with a hollow sense of justice. Even if their property is recovered, it may be locked in an evidence vault for years while the case is decided in court.
We are seeing a general trend, I would say, across the state that the property victims tend to be not given as high a priority. They're more the forgotten victim.
Of course, Winston's office cannot magically solve every person's problems. But she says the office carries weight, and they might be able to at least get more information than individuals could get on their own. And if the case can't be taken any further, at least the organization's clients will know every avenue was explored.
Even if they don't like the end result, I think all people benefit from understanding how the end result came to be. What was the method to the madness of it all? It takes you out of the dark.
The Office of Victims' Rights is a state agency folded underneath the legislative branch, giving them a degree of independence. Their services are free, and Winston says no one should hesitate to call on them if they need help.
There's no right or wrong case. The only thing that has to be met is our jurisdictional requirements, is that they do have to be a victim of a crime for us to open a file, and that would be a victim of any felony crime in the state of Alaska, any misdemeanor, or any domestic violence-related event.
Winston adds that victims whose cases run into a brick wall can always turn to government leaders to try and get more support for law enforcement and improve the parts of the justice system that may have failed them. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The port of Dutch Harbor will hang on to its title as the nation's busiest fishing port for another year. According to new rankings from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, about 753 million pounds of seafood were landed there last year. That's more than any other port in America, and it marks the 17th consecutive year Dutch Harbor has gotten the distinction. It's mostly due to the large volume of pollock brought in from the Bering Sea, along with crab and groundfish. Overall, Alaska's fishing ports saw the biggest value from their catch. Kodiak came in third with landings worth $153 million. Cordova, Naknek, and Sitka were in the top 10, with Ketchikan, Petersburg, and Seward trailing close behind. Those ports were also some of the busiest in the country, thanks to a record-breaking salmon season. Alaska seafood landings spiked 26%, getting close to 5.8 billion pounds of fish. Alaska rates near the bottom in a nationwide survey on how states are improving energy efficiency programs. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, a state energy official says the survey may not be giving Alaska enough credit for the programs it has put in place in recent years.
Energy policy analysts say the U.S. industrial base is riddled with energy inefficiency. A 2009 study by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory says the United States wastes more than half of all energy it produces due to such inefficiencies as unused waste heat from power plants and poorly heated and insulated buildings. The Washington, D.C.-based American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy has for 8 years now been tracking those inefficiencies and issuing an annual survey on how and whether states are making progress to improve. Annie Giglio, the council's state policy research analyst, said in a Wednesday teleconference announcing this year's survey that energy efficiency doesn't just save money, it also boosts economies.
The benefits of energy efficiency have been proven. We see it creating jobs. We see it saving customers money on their energy bills. We see it cleaning up environments.
This year's survey shows Alaska, for the second consecutive year, rated 47th in the nation, with Mississippi, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming rounding out the bottom five.
Most of these states at the bottom have not made energy efficiency a priority in their policies, with low scores across the board.
Much of Alaska's low rating is based on the state's failure to develop energy efficiency policies for utilities and the transportation sector. It gave credit to some state policies, such as those based on legislation passed in 2010 that, among other things, sets a goal of generating half of the state's electricity with renewable energy sources by 2025. But the state doesn't get credit for that because it's voluntary, not required. Sean Scaling is the Alaska Energy Authority's Deputy Director for Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency. He believes Alaska's low rating is largely because the council isn't giving enough credit for the state's energy conservation efforts.
The state government-led initiatives are where our score is very good, actually. We're well above average there.
Scaling's referring to the high marks that the council gave for the state's Village Energy Efficiency Program, which provides audits for public buildings in remote communities and helps pay for improvements, and the Commercial Building Energy Audit Program, which provides similar help for those qualifying private sector property owners. Scaling suspects the council's low rating for Alaska is based, at least in part, on statistical quirks arising from a small population spread over a large area in a cold region requiring high energy use.
You know, things just are a little different in Alaska, sometimes a lot different.
The council also credits Alaska for its two residential energy efficiency think tanks, including the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Energy Rebate Program, which gives qualifying homeowners up to $10,000 to improve their house's energy efficiency. But the council faults Alaska for, among other things, not requiring commercial buildings to comply with thermal and lighting efficiency standards, like those required of all public facilities. It also cites the state's failure to require all new construction to adhere to the state's building energy codes instead of just state-financed construction. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The state has a new library for rocks. The new Geologic Materials Center opened in Anchorage today in what used to be the old Sam's Club. The facility is aimed at giving industry members, academics, and the public access to the wealth of data kept in core samples from around the state. KSKA's Ann Hillman went to the opening.
More than 100 people milled about a white concrete room, poring over conveyor-like roller tables holding boxes of rocks. Some of the cylindrical core samples showed cross-sections of rough sediment. Others were smooth gray.
See how gritty that is? That's sandstone.
Jim Carson from Canrig Drilling Technology offered an impromptu lesson on oil reservoir geology.
So that's the sand where the oil, and then some of this stuff, if you go around, I know it sounds gross, if you go smell that dark-looking rock, you'll smell oil. There's actually oil in there.
Around the room, guests furtively dipped their noses into the samples. Carson says the new facility is nothing like the old center in Eagle River.
To actually see it in this setting now, compared to a dark Connex out in Eagle River with a flashlight, is a huge step forward. This is a world-class facility in Alaska. You should be very proud of it.
The state spent $24.5 million and 2 years to buy and renovate the old warehouse store. They originally planned to spend 9 years and nearly $45 million to build a completely new facility. Dave LePain is a geologist with the Department of Natural Resources and heads the energy section. He says the core collection is an invaluable resource for oil and gas developers in the state because it can help them make predictive models without spending millions on drilling new wells.
A facility like this, I think, is an economic engine for the state. Because as the bigger companies tend to leave the state and smaller companies tend to come in the state, whatever we can do to help them get a leg up and learn the geology of whatever basin they're exploring in, we should do.
GMC curator Ken Papp says the center is like a library of more than 100,000 boxes of rocks where companies and individuals can check out cores and even take new, small samples from them.
So it's kind of a back and forth between, you know, promoting science and the knowledge of the rocks that we have here, and yet keeping things accessible and preserved for future generations to learn about.
Some students started learning about the rocks during the opening ceremony. Eighth graders from Clark Middle School streamed down the endless rows of towering orange shelves. Some, like Emmanuel Nansen, stopped into the private sample viewing rooms. He peered into the beige rock cores, wondering how to extract gold for them, and he couldn't see the point of studying lava.
Yeah. What do you make out of it?
Despite his skepticism, Nansen and his classmate Brandon Sperry say the rocks piqued their interests.
Do you guys think you'll do geology, be involved with rocks when you're older?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah?
50% chance.
Most of the center's samples will stay in Eagle River until the end of winter when it's cheaper to move them. The new center is large enough to almost quadruple the size of the collection through donations. They can also store permafrost and lake sediment samples in the same freezers and refrigerators that used to hold ice cream and bacon. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jennifer Canfield and Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Dan Hillman in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.